Welcome to Heart Smart Conversations with me, Martha Louise, and my two great friends, Mari Mansetti and Lily Benres. Woo! We're three spiritual women with a deep felt desire to help all people understand the transformational power of love and how to implement it into our lives for the better of all mankind. Changing the world starts with each and every one of us, and it starts with experiencing the love we all carry in our hearts. By tapping into this deep, unconditional love intelligence, we can transform our lives for the better. Yes, ladies, today we have an amazing guest here, and I'm so excited to find out everything about this person. Because he has created his own workspace. He has been the main person to start the Turban Day in Norway. He is also the head of diversity, inclusion and belonging at Schibsted, a media firm in Norway with many different branches. Welcome, Sumeet Singh.
Thank you.
We are so excited to have you here.
Me too.
Really?
Can I just ask you, how did you start getting into creating the Turban Day or inclusion in general?
I think growing up in Norway, being a Sikh, having a turban, being different, and also seeing that there was a lot of prejudice, a lot of biases, a polarized public debate, creating an environment where it wasn't cool to be different, where I saw children sort of wanted to embrace the Sikh identity, having a turban, but they didn't dare to because it was scary to be different. And seeing that, I felt also there was some sort of need to bridge a gap. So we sort of had a choice. We Sikhs could sit in our temple at Alnabru in the eastern part of Oslo and expect the whole of Norway to come there and get to know us so that we could create a better society. Most probably people wouldn't. So the other alternative was to meet the society, meet the Norwegians at their premises. So that's what we did. We took our identity, our turbans, our culture, our food to the streets of Oslo and wanted to share that. And surprisingly, people loved that and started embracing that. And we started off with 100 turbans 15 years ago. And now we give away thousands of turbans, people standing queue for 3-4 hours.
Wow.
To get a turban.
Fantastic.
It's such an amazing idea of how to really bridge this and how you can like tear down the walls between cultures. Because I think that's a lot of what it is, right? But what was it like for you to grow up here on the west side? Like kind of the posh area in Norway.
At our primary school, we were three kids that had a different skin color. So we were very different. And I felt very brown and different in that environment. I felt very Indian because in our home, we used to have my dad used to watch Indian debates. Mom watched Indian dramas on ZTV. We watched a Bollywood movie every Saturday. There was Punjabi, the Indian language. And we the garlic, smell of garlic was like tight in the walls and in our clothes. So exiting from that universe every day, entering a Norwegian universe, make me sort of very conscious about being different. But it was never a problem. It wasn't a challenge. It was just a fact that I felt different. Whereas many would think that growing up with looking like this in the western part of Oslo would be very hard, it wasn't hard for me. It was just very different. And I felt that I was accepted and embraced for who I was.
That's great.
Maybe also because I had this sort of strong self-esteem. Mm. So I sort of dared to stand for this. But even though I loved this, I didn't dare to wear a proper turban in my earlier days. I used to have just this bandana or handkerchief. I felt that was sort of more sort of accepted. It wasn't until I entered the army when I was placed at Kolsåsleir. I was a guard there, and 2 weeks into the army, I was called to the chief of the base. So we usually didn't meet him if we, unless we had done something wrong. So I was pretty scared when he had called for me. I remember very clearly entering the office, second floor, there being sort of sweaty and shaking, knocking a door, a dark, like heavy voice saying, come in. And I met this huge guy in there and he said, Singh, sit down. And some of the first thing he said was pointing at my head, the bandana, the handkerchief. And he said, Singh, you look like a pirate with that on your head. And I thought, wow, where is this leading to? Yeah. And then he continued and he said, you know, I've read about you Sikhs, because he was very interested in military and the First and Second World War, where there were a lot of Sikhs in Europe, because Sikhs come from India. India was a British colony. Thereby, a lot of Sikhs were here. And he had sort of seen that. And he said, you know, when I've seen pictures, I've seen these Sikhs having these huge turbans. Aren't you supposed to have that? I said, that's correct. And he said, you know, the first thing people meet when they come to our base is you, the guards. So it's important for us that you look good and representing the army. So I want you, when you come to the duty tomorrow, you have to have this big, huge, beautiful turban. Is that okay? And I said, that's okay. So from that day and onwards, when I didn't come with a proper huge turban, I was sent to my room. I had to tie a proper turban before
I thought that story was going in the completely opposite direction.
And a turban is 7 meters, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's 7 meters. It depends.
Okay.
Some have shorter, some have longer. This is a 6.5 meter long, but it's not so wide. So, but it's everyone has like their sort of style, their textile, and everything is sort of unique.
Yeah, but it may take a long time to
Yeah, now I'm used to it because I practice every day. So it takes a minute or two.
Can you tell us, for the listener who don't know, why you are wearing a turban? Can you tell us why you're doing it?
Yeah, so a turban has sort of some historical roots from India. So in back in the days, it was the kings that used to have a turban. It was a crown in India. The caste system was also standing very strong in India. So that meant that the turban, the crown, was only allowed for the rich people or the kings. And Sikhism sort of was born based on equality and embracing equality. So the Sikhs, our sort of guru, said that, you know, I want all of us, everyone, has the right to have this crown, and all the Sikhs should wear it because we have royal values. So we embrace equality, we embrace everyone, we believe in religious freedom, and anywhere we go in the world, when you see a Sikh, you will recognize him or her and see that that person is a Sikh, and he will help me if I'm in need. So that's sort of the historical background, taking it from the sort of the tops to the people.
That's amazing.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
So
beautiful. Really touching as well.
Are you also thinking of something? Has it anything to do with the crown chakra? We are talking about the crown chakra. Or is it a long...
Or people, of course, have different reasons for it. And I know that some people that practice yoga a lot have says that there are some reasons around that. But whatever, like the things I'm born with or sort of heard at home was the fact that we love being different. And this is about equality. And it sort of shouts that wherever you go.
Wow, I love it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Going to start wearing a turban every day.
All of us.
Very good. It's very good.
But it's that's so interesting. Could you tell us also a bit about your background and how it led you, for example, to meditation? Because I know you've meditated a lot, at least when you were younger.
Yeah. So I think I've always been very spiritual, in the sense that when I was a kid, I used to love playing a priest. So I used to like sit at home and being sort of a priest. I just loved all the history we had and what sort of Sikhism stand for, the stories my mom used to tell me.
What was your favorite story?
I just remember sort of we had the 10 gurus and the last guru had 4 kids. So she told me the sort of story of the 2 youngest kids. They were all of them, unfortunately, were killed fighting for sort of religious freedom and fighting for equality. But the youngest one, I think, was 7 years old. And they sort of got the challenge. Even that 7-year-old kid got the challenge by the rulers by that time. That either you leave your turban and identity and we will let you free, but you have to embrace sort of our faith. But that 7-year-old kid didn't accept that. So he wanted to stay true to his sort of his values. Yeah. So that was sort of very heavy or strong or inspiring for a kid to grow up with and hearing. So I used to sort of love everything with Sikhism. If you listen to the most traditional Sikh music, meditating, and that's been a journey. I think, you know, when you meet difficulties in life, maybe you become a bit more spiritual. And when there are challenges, you sort of focus more on the inside. So when I had sort of those experience in life, I think
what kind of challenges did you have?
We had some I had an elder sister that was 7 years older than me, and she was sort of the brightest kid at school. I remember when she went out from sort of her school, at the she was the best student at the school, she started facing difficulties and illness, and that was sort of hard to see. I remember that that impacted me a lot. At the same time, I see now that, you know, I don't think I would have sort of looked so much on the inside if it wasn't for her. So that sort of was it was a tough experience, but it was a gift, I feel.
So what path did that lead you to?
So I think it led me to dive deeper and deeper, always loving go to India, meeting people that were spiritual and hearing their stories. I just wanted to, you know, when I went to India, I just wanted to meet someone that was spiritual. So I used to ask, do you know anyone that are really spiritual, not just on the outside? Yeah. So I used to meet people and explore new sort of meeting points, venues, and Sikh temples, gurdwaras. So I think at one point of life was, I think where I was at the deepest sort of spiritually, that was when I was studying at a university, and I started meditating. I think I started with meditating 15 minutes every day.
15?
15, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I used to fall asleep. It was tough to stay awake because we meditate in the morning.
Early in the morning, I used to
wake up at 4 o'clock.
When the sun was raising.
Yeah. So the principle is that you shouldn't stress that. Oh, I need to go to school or I need to get that bus or something. You just sit and focus.
But are you supposed to do it when the sun rises?
Yeah, we say that, but we say that
because in Norway that's a bit difficult in the summer. I guess.
Yeah. So in Norway that's impossible.
Sunny all the time. Sun doesn't go down.
Yeah, so it's more less like do it before sort of all the life stress starts. And I used to then I sort of exceeded that from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. And I think at one point I was at 45 minutes, and I was really proud. And my dad was proud. I remember he spoke to this spiritual person in India, and he was like bragging, you know, Sumit, he wakes up at 4 o'clock and he meditated 40 minutes.
Wow.
And that guy, somehow, I don't know why, he just said that, yeah, but he's not doing it from the deep heart. He's just doing it for practical reasons.
Oh.
I don't know. That was just his statement. I remember I cried when I heard that because I was like, I'm sacrificing so much and it isn't deep enough. So
why do you think he said that to you?
I don't know why he said it. If that was just if it was something real there, or if he just was sort of playing a role, I don't know. But what happened with me is that I thought, okay, you know, tomorrow I'm gonna wake up at 2 o'clock. And I'm really going to do this sort of with my full heart. So I did that. And
how many hours did you meditate for that when you got up at 2 in the
morning? No, so that day I remember that I felt something very special when I meditated. So I felt I went deeper than ever. I didn't fall asleep. And I sat there first, I think it was for an hour without sort of thinking about anything. And that felt so good. So the hunger for experiencing that again made me sort of follow that path. So I think for I think a year or so, I used to wake up then every day at 2 o'clock and meditate till 6 o'clock ish. Sleep for half an hour and then go to school. But
so you slept a half an hour after your meditation?
Yeah, yeah. Just took a deep sleep. And wow. But the paradox is that I've never slept so little, but I've never had so much energy either. So it was, I felt everything went well at school and everything. So,
but you felt then that you were touched by something.
Yeah, yeah, I really felt.
So it wasn't any longer something you did because you should do it. It was like a need in you to have that experience, that deep experience again.
Yeah, yeah. I felt I experienced something deeper that I felt. Nobody could like say that, you know, you didn't experience that. Mm. That was something like that. I felt it and I felt that was special. So
yeah.
So yeah. Then it was reality. And I know that that experience was is real.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe this guy in India saw your potential. That you could come to this.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, thanks to him. He had this harsh language, but yeah. But really,
it was powerful. Yeah. And then you started to work and see the diversity or. Like you're now.
How did you
head
end
of,
up with
yeah,
how
being did you, yeah.
Yeah.
Head of diversity, inclusion, and belonging?
Yeah. No. Now the topic is about following your heart, and just a disclaimer: I'm very risk averse. I feel that I don't often dare to sort of follow my heart. Just an example: I took MSc in business and economics for 5 years. And then after that, I dared to sort of then study art and design, which if I really had followed my heart, maybe I would start there.
Yeah.
So I had
to do something proper first.
That's okay, cool. Then I can do something fun. And maybe that's what I did in my career as well. So I started as in finance with investment controlling. Follow sort of more corporate life with the sort of more strategy and engagement and transformation. But at sort of after work, I used to then work with diversity and inclusion in the society. That was like my hobby and my passion. And I think I was lucky enough to follow that. Even when I studied, I remember my mom and dad used to say, you know, this is so good for society. This is, a voluntary work. So don't worry about sort of, people or other students have part-time work. This is your part-time work. We will pay your salary. So I was lucky enough to sort of do that as a hobby. And I think after 12 years sort of in work life, I saw that there was an opportunity because a lot of companies started getting sort of... a more maturity around diversity and inclusion. I felt when I used to work in the earlier days, when we talked about diversity, we limited it to one thing, and that was gender diversity. And I felt very excluded from that. So, so we focus on one diversity dimension and we can talk negatively about everyone else. Mm. So I didn't feel the inclusion part, but the maturity was growing. Coming from the US and UK, of course, but also being relevant in Norway. So then when Schibsted wanted to sort of focus this from not just being a gender diversity, but all kinds of diversity, because they felt that this is good for innovation, having different dimensions or people perspectives around the table is good for product development. If we're the similar people working with one thing, we won't have the best products. And it's good for our talents because we will get the best talent from the bigger pool. And the talents will thrive much better. Then I felt, you know, my experience, 12 years sort of experimenting with work life, have made me, given me a toolbox I can use.
Mm.
But my, I follow my passion also, so I have a deeper knowledge on diversity inclusion, and these two intersecting, suddenly, when I saw that, I was like, okay, this is, I can't work with anything else anymore, mm-hmm. because this is it's who I am, this
so
is me.
Important.
Mm.
So suddenly I felt like, you know, doing, usually we do the Turban Day once a year, and I felt there's opportunity, I can do this every year, mm-hmm. and I can get paid for it.
Every day, I mean.
Yeah, every year. I could do it every day.
Yeah.
That was sort of me. And from that day and onwards, there was sort of no backing. I can't work in finance anymore. This is sort of who I am. Mm. And I feel it's as important as finance.
Absolutely.
Or even more. But with that knowledge, I think I can make it more relevant in a business world as well. Because I think that's important also, that I am not in my echo chamber and believe that just any kind of diversity will always be relevant for any business. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of tie it to your business model and the task you are to do.
Because last time we spoke, you said that there was a female boss that had said, you're not so good at this economy thing. You need to get into.
Yeah. So when I came from finance, I started working for an executive vice president. I remember she was like, all theory I learned about inclusion, she is sort of the practical version of that. She was able to identify my strengths. She was like, you know, after work, you work with Turban Day, you create this engagement. You're good at that. Why don't you do this here in Telenor?
Mm.
This is what you know. You're able to communicate, understand the sort of the people you are meeting and reaching out to. So let's just exit those Excel sheets and start focusing on what you're good at. And she started sort of that dialogue with me. And that was sort of, I didn't have the self-esteem and thinking that, okay, I can do that at work as well. So she identified something I didn't see, and she built it up. And so I think that she didn't give born to that feeling, but at least gave me conscious about my real strengths. Mm. And maybe Excel sheet wasn't sort of my real strength.
She saw your heart.
Yeah, definitely. She saw something and I wasn't able to see or didn't have the self-esteem to see. So. Mm.
And how long have you been working at Schibsted now?
So approximately 2.5 years.
Yeah. And have you seen any results among the employees?
Yeah, it's, you know, this. It's difficult to measure an area like this.
Mm.
But I would say that we have a great ambition, which is anchored at the top. We have KPIs regarding diversity, inclusion, and belonging, which we have to deliver each year, which is anchored at the top. And
that's great.
Yeah, so it's sort of key performance indicators. So you say, okay, for instance, one of the organization last year, we said, you know, this organization, 90% of the employees should go through a diversity, inclusion, and belonging extensive training. So then we have to deliver on that. Otherwise, the bosses will not get their bonuses. So it's sort of anchored at the very top. And there we have delivered a lot. I think we have we roll out this diversity index, for instance, where we measure the diversity, inclusion, and belonging maturity of a company. And I think that tool is, innovative tool. And it's measuring diversity in a much more mature way rather than just counting.
Mm.
Because we... You know, we talk about diversity as sort of representation, which is right. But we also talk about diversity as sort of linking it to innovation and value creation. And in order to do that, you need to measure it correctly as well. So I think we have that tool in place to really, really do this in the right manner. And yeah, that just to give an example of things we've rolled out and anchored in the whole company. But the maturity is, I think, increasing in that organization where we rolled out the maturity index. We see that the organization is not just, you know, there are five levels. So the one level is sort of meeting sort of the government requirements. The second is sort of being aware of diversity being valuable. And the third level is sort of utilizing diversity. So this organization is actually closer to the level three.
Yeah.
And that says something. So it's not just about meeting a law, but actually seeing the value of it and utilizing that in the business.
So it's not just being forced to do something by law.
No.
It is actually taking it and using it and seeing the value that it actually also creates business.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we see is happening now.
Yeah.
But shouldn't it be included in the school?
So you could argue that rather than going 1 year in the army, you should maybe have a course in diversity, inclusion, and belonging. Yeah, definitely. I think we. Yeah. That would be ideal. If at least if you meet a chief that I had, but I think yes. I think this is you know the society is more diverse than ever before. Mm. We have knowledge about people being different, and that that's totally fine. It's not something positive or negative. We are just different, and understanding and not navigating in that. I think that's important at school. It's important at work. It's important in society. Mm. But I also think we are building towards the future where that will be a natural component. So those that understand it, they will survive.
Yes.
And those that don't will be irrelevant.
Yeah.
As I see it, the officer at the army, he saw your core and saw your strength and your heart and also the woman. And now you have taken all your experiences and you help and see other people to blossom in their work, and that's so important. You have done exactly the same, or you do today exactly the same thing that they did to you when you grew up, and they formed you in a way because they saw you. We have talked about that we also, when we are seen, we dare to do much more, and we can stand and be yourself, and that's that gives us so much more power.
Mm.
And as I can see it, it's given you enormously power to be you, because you have the really big, big heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, but I think like what I do is sort of maybe a high level thing.
Yeah.
Because the examples I gave about my leader and the army officer, they saw me at a deeper level, right? So this is what we call sort of inclusive trait. Mm. They were curious, and curiosity is not sort of just asking a superficial question. It's active listening. It's really making you feel seen, as you say. And they had those traits.
Yeah.
And according to Deloitte review, you see that if leaders have those inclusive traits, it makes sort of an employee can potentially have the feeling of fairness, growing 70%. Percent points. And when that happens, you see the decision making quality, collaboration increases dramatically. So it's also sort of it's a deeper trait you can practice, of course, but I think that's harder from I think I must practice much more to be curious. They had it naturally. That army officer reading about something that wasn't his normal, and when he read about that, he really saw me, and he saw me more than the eyes could see.
Yeah.
And that's real curiosity.
And that's very important.
I have the feeling that you do the same with people.
Yeah, me too. I'm sorry.
I'm going to say, like, this is not just intellectual for you. I'm sorry. But I have the feeling that you really see people. Yeah. And that's why you manage to maneuver within all the different layers and all the different people that you surround yourself with, and why you manage to get through to the leaders who don't understand too, and why and how you manage to get all of them to collaborate and see things differently. That's a talent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really a talent. And that comes from your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. I think maybe also it's because we're like, because I felt being an outsider. So my sort of sensors are on to sort of understand sort of the inclusive side. But I can be better at curiosity. I think that's it. Those that are curious, that you see it in the eyes.
But at the same time, I was also listening to you when you talked about the story your mother told about a seven-year-old who didn't take away his turban. To have a mother like that, and she taught you how to be in your heart and how to be in your truth, that's so important. So it's like connecting the dots. It led to who you are today and what you're doing to all of us, to be there and teach us to be ourselves. And that's what this podcast is all about. It's to be yourself and be in your heart and stand for who you are. And it's so, so important. And then be there.
No, and I, you know, all my life, or before I met my wife, I thought that I was mostly impacted by my dad, because me and my dad, we are close friends. We speak every day, and I like, I'm very inspired by all his story. But it was my wife saying that, you know, it's your mother, when she saw my mother and I sort of gotten closer with her, seeing that, you know, who you are is due to your mother, because she you know, no matter how ugly I look, how like fat I've become, or how bad I sort of deliver, she is always sort of, she never sees it. It's just crazy. And I also believe her when she says that, Sumit, you look so good. And I believe her. And
that's great.
But she has given me that self-confidence, I think. And, you know, looking back, you know, there was times where people tried to bully me. But I answered, because I had that like self-esteem. And that was due to her. Maybe like less actually my dad.
So beautiful. And what's your what you want to do for the future, or what's your hope for the future and business and including and
inclusion and
inclusion?
No, my future hope, I don't know, but I think you know, when I was younger, I sort of started working with young Sikhs, because I saw this gap, and I saw these young kids and not being able to have that platform to embrace the identity they wanted to embrace. Now growing older, seeing my parents getting retired, seeing that, you know, they've invested all their life just to create a platform for our generation. They didn't have anything. They didn't have any heritage. They didn't have any cottages at the mountains. They didn't have time to have any hobbies. They've just, they came here with their dream to have a safe future. And now seeing them getting retired, and they have sort of prioritized our future, meaning that they don't have those hobbies now. They don't have any cottages to go to. So now, like, my dream is more that that generation of immigrants in Norway, the elder ones, to also focus on them. So earlier it was on the youngsters, now maybe the elders, that, you know, what they did, that's unique, right? Coming in 70s to Norway from a totally different world. Yeah, so they deserve also to that scene, and that they also get sort of a senior club that is inclusive, and that their retiring life also sort of... is really seen by the society and the government.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. Usually at the end, we have like an exercise or just something,
a practice
that we can do every day for people for next week. Do you have something that comes to mind?
Yeah. So yeah, just back to curiosity, just being curious, and, you know, ask questions to people, ask big questions, ask questions without a negative starting point, open questions. I think that will make us relevant for the future, being curious about the people around us, about different worldviews, and that will make other people feel seen. So next time you're in an elevator, don't be still, just ask a question, an open question. Don't limit it to what you see. So if you just see the turban, you don't have to be curious about that turban, but maybe something else. Yeah.
Oh, well, what would you suggest be a first question then?
I think somebody told me, you know, the best question you can ask is the follow-up question. and I think that was good because the first question is maybe easier. But if you have a follow-up question, then you practice curiosity a little bit.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
That's a strong one.
Thank you so much for sharing
with thank us you
from
very
your
very
heart
much.
And
thank
how
you.
Your heart you. Changes the world.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the work you do. Thank you. And being you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Art Smart Conversations.